It's 8 o'clock on Tuesday, the 18th of June on RT Radio 1. You're listening to Morning Ireland with Rachel English and Cathal McCulley in Dublin and Sean O'Rourke in Fermanagh.
The news headlines. As the G8 leaders gather in County Fermanagh for a second day of their summit, agreement on Syrian peace talks is reported to be close. NATO is formally handing over command of combat operations in Afghanistan to the Afghan government today. And a court in Greece has ordered that the state broadcaster there, ERT, back on air following its closure by the government 6 days ago. With the news in detail now, here's Brian Jennings.
Leaders of the G8 countries are attending the second and final day of talks near Lough Erne in County Fermanagh today. The issue of Syria featured prominently during discussions yesterday. Last night, the Russian President Vladimir Putin is reported to have come under pressure to agree to plans by Britain, the US and France aimed at ending the war in Syria during a private dinner for all the G8 leaders, which was hosted by the British Prime Minister David Cameron. British officials now suggest that agreement could be close on a summit conclusion backing the launch of Syrian peace negotiations in Geneva. The agenda today includes discussions on tax havens and on monies paid by big business to government figures. The leaders will also be addressing counter-terrorism at their morning session, which gets underway in half an hour's time. From Enniskillen, our economics correspondent Sean Whelan.
Tax and transparency are two of the big themes of this summit, with Prime Minister David Cameron looking for agreement on ways governments can get more information, in the case of tax, on who has money stashed in offshore tax havens like Bermuda, the Cayman Islands or the Isle of Man. He also wants to see big business, especially oil and mining companies, disclosing more about the payments, either commissions or outright bribes, they pay to government figures in developing countries. Under the heading counter-terrorism, political leaders will talk about the radical Islamist movements in North and West Africa. Sean Whelan, RTE News, Enniskillen.
President Obama's wife, Michelle, is due to visit Glendalough this morning with their two daughters. Amid tight security, they will be given a guided tour of the 6th century monastic site in the Wicklow Mountains National Park. NATO is formally handing over command of combat operations in Afghanistan to the Afghan government today. The ceremony attended by President Karzai and the NATO Secretary General, Anders Rasmussen, is being held in Kabul this morning amid tight security. The complete withdrawal of international combat troops from Afghanistan is due to take place at the end of next year. Primary school teachers have voted to accept the Haddington Road proposals on public service pay. In a ballot last night, members of the Irish National Teachers Organisation voted to back the proposals with 63% in favour. Among other measures, the proposals contain improved salary scales for newly qualified teachers. Post-mortem examinations on the bodies of 27-year-old Yolanta Lobienia and her 8-year-old daughter Enrica will resume this morning at Kerry General Hospital in Tralee. Their bodies were found at a house in Killorglan in County Kerry on Sunday night. Gardaí are continuing to treat the two deaths as suspicious, but the status of their investigation is expected to change to a double murder once the preliminary results become available. The Greek state broadcaster ERT is to be allowed back on air after a court suspended a government order to shut it down last week. However, the Prime Minister, Antonis Samaras, is being allowed to reduce the size of the organisation. The closure led to protests from his coalition partners, who warned they could force a snap election. Nikos Migrelis, a journalist with ERT, said the significance of the court decision should not be underestimated.
We managed to beat the government. And this is something enormous. This is something amazing. This is something unbelievable, and I'm very happy for this.
Now the time is coming up to 5 minutes past eight.
Here again with what it says in the papers is Clodagh Walsh.
The photos say it all on the front of the papers this morning, from a beaming Michelle Obama and her daughters, a relaxed looking President Obama and David Cameron with a group of schoolchildren in Enniskillen, to the remains of a young mother and her daughter being removed from their home in Killorglan, County Kerry. The Irish Daily Mail, Irish Examiner and The Herald all lead with the discovery in Killorglan of the bodies of Yolanta Lubienia and her daughter Enrica. It's reported, as you heard in our own bulletin, that a murder inquiry is expected to be launched following the results of the post-mortem later today. And while the Irish Times lead concentrates on the business at hand at the G8 summit, it's Michelle Obama who steals the limelight. The front of the Irish Sun, we're only barack for the crack. So good to be home, the headline in the Irish Independent, above a photo of Mrs. Obama and her two daughters. With Lee's handwriting that for this island nation, it was a day of firsts. From the First Lady to another oratorical wonder from her husband, the US President. Both their contributions for the G8 visit sent the message that Ireland had turned a corner. Inside, there's page after page of photos, as there is in all the papers. Plenty on what the Obama family were up to yesterday, and lots of coverage of Michelle Obama's speech in both Belfast and Dublin, where, as the Times puts it, she stressed the importance of community, tradition and personal resilience. Elsewhere in that paper, Arthur Beasley reminds us that while the serious business of the summit started yesterday as the leaders discussed the global economy, this morning tax will dominate. With new efforts to clamp down on aggressive avoidance by big business high on the agenda. This, he says, is something which could yet cause problems for Ireland. And the business of the summit is well and truly dissected and analysed in the papers this morning. Following the publication of photos of celebrity chef Nigella Lawson being held around the throat by her husband Charles Saatchi, Mr. Saatchi's explanation that it was just a playful tiff continues to get a great deal of coverage in the papers this morning. There are several articles in the Mail and the Examiner questions whether it was just a tiff or heavy-handed. Elsewhere, that paper reports that a New York medical examine officer employee has been suspended after the body of a young Irishman from Newry was placed in a van full of rubbish after his tragic death over the weekend. The man was killed in an apparent hit-and-run incident. A photo showing the body being placed in the back of the medical examiner van next to clear bags of recycling has, we're told, sparked outrage in the Irish-American community. And from The Independent, the story of a young couple who were held at knife point and robbed of €10,000 as they waited in a car park to pay for a car they had bought by phone. The couple were confronted by two armed men wearing balaclavas instead of the seller whom they were expecting. The Examiner reports on a new high-tech facility at the Midwestern Regional Hospital in Limerick, which will allow keyhole surgery on colon cancer patients. The Stryker iSuite Theatre is the first voice-activated integrated operating theatre of its type in this country and enables surgeons confer with colleagues across the world by video link. And finally, more photos and a story carried by most of the papers. Better known as Cha and Maya, Frank Duggan and Michael Toomey, along with entertainer Billa O'Connell, were granted the freedom of Cork City yesterday for their contribution to theatre in the city. The Cha and Maya Act began in 1969 and continued for 43 years, while Billa O'Connell performed in his first pantomime in 1947.
Welcome back. You're listening to Morning Ireland at 12 minutes past 8. Fair taxation for multinational companies. Transparency on sales, profits, ownership and tax paid and where are concepts most of us would agree with straight away. But when you get down to the detail, well, it's a little bit more complicated, especially if you're one of the eight leaders gathered for the second day of the G8 summit on the shores of Lough Erne. Now, we do know that the G8 leaders have a plan for some limited measures, which comes from the OECD. It's been published overnight, to talk about that and about where this whole trend is going. We're joined by Jim Stewart, Senior Lecturer in Finance at Trinity College Dublin. Jim, good morning again.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming in. Now, first of all, what the OECD is proposing, can you describe it for us in a nutshell and the significance of it?
Well, I should start by way of background that there has been a voluntary system of exchange, but this has not worked very well.
Exchange of information.
Exchange of information between countries. So, for example, the major changes that have occurred in the US and other countries have a result of leaking of information, in particular in relation to UBS. The same thing happened in Liechtenstein in Germany and more recently in UBS in France. In some cases, actually, the Secret Services seem to be involved in this leaking of information. And this information has resulted in a threat of indictment against UBS and other Swiss bank companies. It led to the passing of legislation, the FATCA legislation it's called in the US, which involves the exchange of information by banks in relation to accounts held by US citizens to the IRS. Now, the EU have rowed in on the back of this and they want to get agreements between Luxembourg and Austria and other countries. So the voluntary exchange hasn't worked very well. So now the proposal is that it will become automatic. And Cameron managed to persuade the Crown dependencies and the overseas territories to sign up to some sort of agreement. I think there are problems in trying to make it automatic, because the OECD said we'll only do that if it can be secured. The data must be secure when it's being transmitted, must be done electronically, and countries must have the administrative capacity to absorb this information. Now, can I say that the OECD do a lot of very good work, but they don't have a great track record in negotiating with countries. For example, they had a plan and they had a program to identify tax havens, and they identified 4 criteria for tax havens in 1998. They identified 35 tax havens in the year 2000. And the Irish ambassador was able to write to the US Senate to say that Ireland is not a tax haven according to these 4 criteria. But the unfortunate thing is no country is regarded as a tax haven. It's completely empty.
Would a cynic be right to say that what the OECD is tabling and explaining, we gather, to the G8 leaders is actually a fairly basic system for improved communication, improved exchange of information that actually isn't going to change all that much?
Well, it could have significant implications, because it would formalise what's happening in relation to the US and Swiss banks. So it means that all countries would sign up to this. Now, you have to have the capacity to absorb this information and use it. See, on a voluntary system, if a country asks for particular information, it's provided. But you have to know the questions to ask. So now you get all of this information anyway. Now, you'd wonder, are they already collecting this from what you hear about the NSA, and why don't they use that information? But nevertheless, it would make it formal, but it has to be confidential.
Right. You said all countries would sign up to this. There's a kind of an if in brackets there, isn't there?
Well, the OECD countries would sign up to it, and then hopefully the tax havens would sign up to it. The 8 Crown dependencies have already signed up to it, according to Cameron.
Now, for you, where does all... Because this is fairly humble, fairly basic stuff, but let's assume they agree on something like this later today. How does that fit into the bigger picture of where this is going and what's next?
The bigger picture has been that there's been a considerable attack on bank secrecy. And this arose, as I said, from the leaking of this document. Swiss banks have had to supply a lot of information to the US government. The same thing is going to happen in relation to German citizens with accounts in Switzerland. They'll have to provide a lot of information as well. So I think bank secrecy is going to be severely curtailed for Switzerland, Luxembourg and Austria. The problem is that bank secrecy is only one part of the picture. You need to get at other assets. And this is where Cameron has introduced this idea of a registry of companies. And he wants to have Companies House in the UK organise this. I'm not quite sure how that will work out.
If you're a company like Google, you employ 3,000 people in Ireland, you make 9 billion in profits, and then you have to pay for the use of Google's information, knowledge. And that costs you roughly over 90% of your profits. So your profits get paid to effectively are located in Bermuda, which doesn't have corporation tax. Do you see any early likelihood of that kind of the regime which permits that changing?
I think that the G8 will endorse and extend changes that are already been taking place, for example, in relation to accounting disclosure. There's an EU accounting directive has recently been passed, which requires extractive industries to disclose payments to governments. And that's all large, and that follows US legislation. The EU have extended this on foot of the Google issue to all listed companies in Europe. So companies like Google will have to disclose the payments they're making to governments, and there'll be increased transparency. So I think if governments and citizens realise the extent of tax payments or non-tax payments by companies, that will put pressure on them to increase their tax payments. But it's a transparency issue. It's very difficult to actually force them.
Exactly. And there is such a myriad. There are hundreds and hundreds of tax treaties and tax arrangements between 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 groups of countries, the EU and so on and so on. Do you see any early likelihood of that actual... Politicians will talk about this, but do you see any early likelihood of specifics changing so that, for example, where a country's sales... People would know where a company's sales arise, where their profits arise, where they're paying tax or not?
Yes, I think that it's possible, with the evidence and the scrutiny of Google in the UK, that Google sales in the UK will be changed, the definition of the sales they're making in the UK. Similar thing might happen in France and in Germany, but it will require the UK tax authorities and tax authorities in other countries to devote far more effort in actually to tracking down. this sort of data. It is a very difficult with internet-based companies. Where are the sales actually taking place? What are the profits being made in different countries?
By the sound of it, you're saying that things which have a big impact on us could be not far away.
I think there is the risk. And I think that's the problem. It creates uncertainty. And what business making investments, what they don't want is uncertainty. So there is a risk that there would be change, and it could be unilateral, because to some extent, the UK and other governments say, look, everything must change. Nothing can change unless everything changes. I think there is scope for one country making a particular change, acting unilaterally.
Well, there's certainly political pressure for it. Jim Stewart, thank you very much.
The country's largest teaching union, the INTO, has voted to accept the Haddington Road Agreement. That's the successor to the Croke Park Agreement. Now, under the New Deal, national school teachers will no longer be paid the current supervision and substitution allowance, and those earning over €65,000 will face pay cuts. With us is the General Secretary of the INTO, Sheila Noonan. Good morning.
Morning, Rachel.
37% of your members who voted, they rejected the proposals, and they're going to be disappointed this morning. So what would you say to them?
Well, of course they're going to be disappointed. In fact, the people who have voted for this agreement are not exactly going to be joyous either. No matter what way you look at it, public servants and my members in particular, primary school teachers, are going to find themselves with a reduced pay packet over the course of the lifetime of this agreement. But what I would say to them is this, that it was the view of myself and my executive in relation to the Haddington Road proposals that we had made progress since our members rejected Croke Park 1, and that we absolutely believe that what is facing them in the Haddington Road proposals is considerably better than the government alternative as envisaged in the FEMPI legislation, which is going to cut pay and freeze increments from the 1st of July.
Yet the other two teaching unions, the ASTI and the TUI, they both oppose these proposals. So have they got it wrong?
No, in fairness to my colleagues in the TUI and the ASTI, we all make our own sovereign decisions in relation to that. We looked at it very specifically as the measures impact on primary school teachers, the choices that were available to those teachers, the progress that we felt was made from the first set of proposals, and the prospect that was facing teachers in respect of the legislation. And it was a choice we put before our members. It wasn't an easy choice, it wasn't an elegant choice, but it is a choice that the majority of our members have now accepted, and it is our job now is to move on from that and to ensure that the agreement is upheld.
Do you think that those other two unions, the ASTI and the TUI, that they should put these proposals to their members, because so far they haven't said that they'll do that?
That is entirely a matter for the executive of the ASTI and the TUI, and they carry out their business in exactly the same way that we carry out our business, in full consultation with their own membership as expressed through their executive, and they will make their own decisions as they feel appropriate to their members.
Can we talk about some of the provisions in this new agreement? There is now, and this may surprise some people outside of the public service, a provision to restore original salary levels. When's this due to happen?
Well, in the case, first of all, there's two aspects of this. One is in respect of people who are having a pay cut. Public servants and teachers who are earning more than 65,000 have now very firm dates for restoration in respect of that 5.5% pay cut. It comes in two moieties from April 2017 and the following year in terms of January. And then more important for our own members in respect of the allowance you mentioned, the supervision allowance, which is in effect a pay cut, it's an pensionable allowance. There's also restoration envisaged for that particular payment, and that's important, I think, for our members.
So come 2018 then, your members should be back to earning what they were earning before?
Absolutely, and that was an important consideration of members in respect of these proposals.
Where now then for this agreement overall? Because it's clear that the unions are split on this.
Well, the agreement differs, as you'll know, from the previous set of proposals, and that it is up to individual unions to register their own particular position with government, which we will now be doing speedily to ensure our members do not suffer an increment freeze as envisaged by the legislation. That's a matter for every individual union. Government are going to proceed with the legislation. It's up to unions to avoid that by registering agreement, and that is a matter for every individual union.
When it came down to it, did your members accept this not because they liked it in any way, but because really they couldn't handle a strike?
No, our members, in fairness, in relation and a very strong mandate for industrial action, but very much put it up to myself and the negotiators to use that mandate very effectively on their behalf in the revised set of proposals to ensure that we came back to them with progress in respect of the original set of proposals. Our members are very sensible people that look at the choices facing them at this particular point in time. There are further battles we will be fighting on behalf of education facing into a next budget with pay cuts and visits. Or not pay cuts, with a cut in the education budget of 44 million envisaged again, and they want to, if you like, settle the ground at this point in time and move on and campaign on other issues.
Sheila Noonan, General Secretary of the Irish National Teachers Organisation, thank you for joining us.
Now, from questions about the present to questions about the past, specifically our recent disastrous banking past, on which there's general political agreement that an inquiry is needed, but none yet on who should conduct that inquiry. John McGuinness, chairperson of the Public Accounts Committee, is keen, but as one of the Labour members of his committee told us on yesterday's programme, Derek Nolan of the Labour Party, on why he believed John McGuinness was not the person to chair it.
Probably the primary reason why he's disqualified himself, in my view, from being chair of a banking inquiry is the perception of bias that he has created through his comments, which I described in that session, which I described as a farce last Thursday. During that session, he speculated that he'd made enemies with the civil service because of his book. He talked about the toll for democracy, the demise of democracy, that civil servants were out to get him because of possibly how he chairs the committee. And he made a very serious accusation that a government department is leaking against him.
Derek Nolan, Labour TD, speaking to us yesterday. We're joined now by another member of the committee, Independent TD, Shane Ross. Good morning.
Good morning, Cal.
First of all, are you happy with John McGuinness as chairperson of the Public Accounts Committee, and then the specific issue of whether he should chair a banking inquiry if the PAC gets to do it?
I think he answered the questions adequately about the specific charges which have been made against him last week. I think the... So I think he can continue, yeah, as chairman of the PAC, certainly. I think the issue of the banking inquiry is a completely different one. And I agree with Derek Nolan. I think that both he is unsuitable to be a chairman of the banking inquiry, and any member of the PAC, and indeed probably any TD, is unsuitable to be chairman of the banking inquiry. Specifically, I mean, the reasons that Derek raised were specifically about civil servants and what he said about civil servants, and they're likely to be players in the banking inquiry, and so he's prejudged it. But, I mean, if you take my own instance, I'm a member of the PAC. I've written a book about bankers, and it's been extraordinarily critical of bankers. And I think that the people who would welcome more than anybody an Oireachtas inquiry chaired by TDs would be the bankers themselves. I think they'd love to see it. They'd have us up and down in the High Court day and night saying you've prejudged this issue, and they'd make an absolute circus of it. And I think it's now at this stage, particularly because politicians, civil servants and bankers are involved in this and have an agenda and have been criticised, I think it's essential that it's probably taken out of the arena and given to an outsider or certain outsiders. You know, it's essential that we have a banking inquiry. But it's also essential that it doesn't turn into a sort of circus, which the PAC did actually in its second half last week.
And yet the PAC has run inquiries into very difficult issues before, and sensitive issues and controversial issues of taxation, for example.
It ran an excellent inquiry into the banking in the 1990s, you're quite right.
The
Dirt inquiry. But that was a kind of different issue in a different time. And I don't know of any case where members of that particular body had prejudged that issue.
Yes, but could you not be accused of being maybe a bit precious on this, in that what happened in our banks was a disaster? The way the banks were regulated and overseen by our politicians was a disaster, and our civil servants. The whole country can see that.
Yeah.
So that doesn't mean you're prejudging it. That's quite a unanimous view.
It means you're prejudging probably the individuals. For instance, I mean, I called for the...
Yeah, but John McGuinness didn't name any individuals.
Well, he wrote a book. I don't know
Nor is any member of the committee, as far as I know.
He wrote a book about it, and he's got a history of being critical of the banks and civil servants. And they're going to take umbrage at this and say, look, this guy's flawed. I think it would be far better if you introduced a model of people who were not politically tinged and didn't have a political agenda, who weren't going to go in there and immediately take a position against the civil servants involved, immediately take a position, for instance, about the politicians going to come before this inquiry as well. And the PAC has got a Fine Gael Labour majority. Are they going to come in and attack the Fianna Fáil people, and the Fianna Fáil people attack the Fine Gael people who may have been involved? That's going to happen.
And it's going to be political theatre, in other words.
It was a political theatre last week. That's what it broke down into on a little probe. Yeah. And what if there's a magnificent
but
inquiry?
Wasn't last week the exception that proves the rule? The PAC is, in general, not a political theatre.
There's no such thing as an exception that proves the rule. It wasn't. It was a test for it, and this was a little probe into one of its members to say, hey, what happened at this? And what happened was two of them, John McGuinness and John Deasy, used it as a political battleground for fighting internal battles. Now, you know what politicians are like. We're all, and I'm as guilty as anybody else, we're all pretty good at grandstanding, right? And we've had a ruckus inquiries before, including the Callaly one, where politicians went out in the plinth during what was an impartial inquiry, grandstood, and in fact, it ended up in the High Court. So what we want to do here, I think there are lots of ways that you could have a really good inquiry. You want boring people, you want accountants, you maybe want a judge. And I can't see anything wrong, Cal, with the idea of possibly, what's wrong with the old jury system? Why don't you take 12 citizens, 12 members of the public, and ask them to hold this inquiry?
Do you think such an inquiry wouldn't end up in the, take ages and end up in the courts as
well? I don't think it would take ages. I think any juror, anybody is subject to challenge. Of course they are when that's happened. And that's absolutely correct.
No, I'm talking about their work. Once even it sets about, won't it take forever and ever? And won't it end up in the courts? Inevitably. It doesn't matter who's in charge.
Well, the PAC one, which you mentioned before, in the 1990s, actually didn't end up.
That's the reason.
And also, it didn't because of the procedures. It wasn't all that expensive. But if you have one with citizens, if you have a very limited time and limited procedures, I think that would happen. If you have politicians, it's going to take far longer because they're going to be in the courts day and night.
Yeah, there is a case for following just what we've been talking about. The Dirt Inquiry was based on an inquiry by the Controller and Auditor General, then with hearings by the Public Accounts Committee. Now, given what you've just been saying, isn't there a reason for going down that route again if we can?
No, because it's a completely and utterly different situation. There was no case for taking the individuals in the PAC inquiry in the 1990s to court. There is a case for taking individuals, indeed like myself, and the bankers will do it, the civil servants will do it, the politicians will do it, the financial regulator will do it, and it'll end up as a complete and utter fiasco.
A final question very briefly, as someone who has a good track record in investigating what went wrong, do we need any inquiry? It's over, it's happened, we know we're living out the consequences. Why dig into it at great expense?
It is absolutely essential that we find out what happened on the night of the bank guarantee. Not because the individuals should necessarily be persecuted, but how the decisions were made. And it is utterly extraordinary that we don't know who made what decisions, who met who, when, and on what basis they were made. There are no papers in the Department of Finance which tell us that. And there's a good reason for doing that, and that's so that it should never, never happen again.
Shane Ross, thank you very much.
It's 25 minutes now to 9. Shortly, we'll be returning to Sean O'Rourke, who's at that G8 summit in County Fermanagh. First of all, though, let's get the sport from Darren. Darren, you have more joke in here from us. Our cup run is over.
Yeah, he's certainly grabbing all the headlines this morning, Rachel, and a lot of confusion over his future now at Newcastle United this morning. He claims he's signed a contract to become the new director of football there. The club have yet to confirm this appointment. The former Newcastle manager gave what can only be described as an extraordinary interview on UK radio station TalkSport last night. He claimed responsibility for signing goalkeeper Tim Krul. He was, in fact, recruited by Graeme Souness. He also said he signed James Perch, a player signed by Chris Hughton. He also struggled to name some of the club's most prominent players. He called Yohan Kabai, Yohan Kebab, and Hatem Ben Arfa, Hatem Ben Arfri. He claimed that he's been named Manager of the Year 3 times, and in fact, he's actually only won it once. He's boasted about his worldwide contacts that were so extensive, no door was closed to him. And when asked about the supporters' negativity towards him, he said he had more intelligence than them.
You know, what do you want? What do they want? And I heard that silly comment, what can I attract? I can open the door to any football manager in the world. Anyone. That's the difference. I can talk, I spend my whole life picking the phone talking to Alex Ferguson, week in, week out. What would you do? What would you do? What would you do? I can pick the phone up at any time of the day and speak to Arsene Wenger. I can pick the phone up and speak to any manager in the league, any manager, in all divisions. So, you know, I don't know what angle they've got. They want to sit down and argue with me. Some of them are just talking out the backside, a load of tosh. I'm not accepting it. It's as simple as that. I've certainly got more intelligence than them, that's for sure.
Well, I wonder how those comments are going to go down in Newcastle this morning. And you wonder now about his future at the club, if he ever did have a future at the club, and whether this director of football role ever did exist. We'll have to wait and see. Let's turn our attention to rugby now. The British and Irish Lions play their final warm-up game ahead of their first test against Australia on Saturday. Warren Gatland's men play the Brumbies in Canberra. The game gets underway at 10:40 Irish time. There's live radio commentary on Longwave 252 and on our digital platforms. Our match commentator is Michael Corcoran, and he joins us live from Canberra Stadium. Michael, the sun, I'm delighted to say, is shining here in Ireland. What are conditions like there?
Oh, the sun, what's that? We've had sleet and snow, in fact, in the last hour and a half here. So much so, we had a hilarious scenario where I was in a cab driving along the highway, and it was just blanketed completely in snow. The cab driver was petrified because he said he's never driven in conditions like this before. And I offered to swap with him and said, listen, we do this on a regular basis, if you don't mind. And I won't bother charging you for the fare either. But no, I mean, it's cleared up. And just keep the fingers crossed that that it stays away. But we did have some heavy rain as well throughout the course of the earlier part of the day. But the conditions in terms of temperature, I'm told, will be somewhere in the region of about -3 for the game this evening. And anybody, I'm lucky because I'm in one of those kind of cocoon behind a glass case here. But some of the people who've been outside have come in and are absolutely frozen. So it is going to be testing conditions for everybody, spectators and players alike.
Michael, it's a make or break week really for the Lions. And, you know, if we look at Warren Gatland's team here this morning or evening in your time, it's largely made up of fringe players, 5 Irish involved. Given that the first game now against Australia just 4 days away, realistically, in your opinion, how many of these Irish can force their way into that first squad?
I don't really see anybody from the starting team that's playing this evening being involved as a starter for the first test this coming weekend. However, I mean, there are still a few in other positions, as far as I would be concerned, you know, to fill on the bench for the game against Australia and Brisbane, where it will be much warmer, obviously, this coming weekend. You know, it's kind of unfortunate that injury has curtailed the involvement of Rob Kearney. But, I mean, when you look at the whole three-quarter line, Christian Wade, Brad Barrett, Billy Twelvetrees and Shane Williams. Billy Twelvetrees is the longest of the four of those in the country, and he only arrived last Friday. So, I mean, that's going to cause a degree of difficulty. The others, to be perfectly fair about it, I think, are maybe Sean O'Brien has a chance of getting to the bench, and I think it's probably going to be a straight shootout between himself and Justin Tipperick to see who fills the bench role in the test team at the weekend.
Michael, a few eyebrows raised with this starting lineup. A lot of this Lions team only joined up with the touring party very recently. Some, you'd imagine, barely have had time to learn the calls or, you know, the various patterns of play. How vulnerable are the Lions today?
They're quite vulnerable, actually, I think. I mean, if you look at the Brumbies team, they've only got 2 players who've played international rugby. Peter Kimlin is in the Wallaby squad at the moment. Clyde Rathbone hasn't played international rugby for a period of time. But, I mean, this team have been together for the last 2 weeks. They beat the Melbourne Rebels in a Super 15 game recently with a bonus point win, and have trained together quite a lot over the last 2 weeks as well. They do have a lot of firepower out wide, as I said. Clyde Rathbone, Henry Spate on the right wing, and Jesse Mogg, the fullback, is quite a decent player as well. So if they can match the lines up front, they certainly have the firepower behind the scrum to cause them a bit of difficulty. It was a tight game, as I said to you previously, here 12 years ago, and I expect tonight is going to be no different whatsoever.
And in a word, call it for us?
Slightly, marginally, the Lions, I would say, just based on the fact that, you know, they've got the cavalry on the bench again, which seems to be the way that Warren Gatland has operated on. They have a much, much stronger bench, and if it is a tight game, I think, and they use the bench, I think the Lions will win this one.
Thanks, Michael. Magician is set to spearhead Aidan O'Brien's bid for a 7th James's Palace Stakes success at Royal Ascot this afternoon. The Irish 2000 Guineas hero suffered a knock last week, but will be fit. That is one of 3 Group 1 races with almost £200,000 sterling each, on worth that amount on each of today's, each race is worth that on today's card. Today's racing gets underway at 2:30, and there's also racing in Sligo from 5:45.
Let's go now to the media centre at the Killyhevelyn Hotel, from where we're joined by George Parker, political editor of the Financial Times. George, British officials are talking up progress on the question of Syria. Now, we know that Vladimir Putin said, yes, they want negotiations, they want people at the negotiating table, they want the violence to stop, they want humanitarian aid to get through. What else can they agree on?
Well, I think that's right. The British do sound quite hopeful. I think we saw from Vladimir Putin yesterday none of the really aggressive language he used when he was in Downing Street over the weekend, where he was talking about some of the opposition fighters ripping out the intestines of their opponents and eating them. You know, so he's toned down the rhetoric. But nevertheless, I think there's still a major sticking point as far as the Russians are concerned. And that's this, which is that the Russians are sticking with the Assad regime. They don't see a viable alternative. And I think over the dinner last night, where Syria was very much on the agenda, I think Vladimir Putin said to the people really having a go at him and said, well, look, what's your alternative? Where is this alternative government you talk about? Is this opposition group that you want to possibly arm capable of taking over the country? And at the moment, he's not prepared to ditch the Assad regime. And I think that's the big sticking point.
And also suggestions of differences as well on the other side of the table, so to speak, with the French and the British not going fully down the road with Obama on supporting the rebels either.
Well, that's right. I mean, President Obama has said he was prepared to arm the rebels. Britain and France, of course, a couple of weeks ago made a very big issue at the European Union in Brussels of the idea of lifting the arms embargo against Syria, allowing them to arm the rebels. But since then, neither country has been actually prepared to say we're actually going to do it. And in the UK, there's a particular problem, which is that David Cameron's government is split on the issue and is very questionable about whether he could command a Commons majority for arming the rebels. So, yes, Barack Obama is the person who's talking about actually sending the weapons in. Britain talking more about providing technical assistance at the moment.
On tax, trade and transparency, the three T's that David Cameron has applied to summarise his priorities at this summit, he talked up again yesterday the idea of the biggest bilateral trade deal in history with these European-American talks now about to begin next month. Is he over-egging the pudding?
Well, I think the trade talks are ambitious, actually. I think this is probably the trade agreement with President Obama is probably the most important thing I would say to come out of this summit in terms of concrete action. It's going to be incredibly technical. We're not talking about old-fashioned trade negotiations where you're taking down tariff barriers. This is about removing things like regulation, over-onerous inspections of goods when they arrive in America or Europe, and all the rest of it. Now, if the negotiators over the next 18, 24 months are able to actually tear down some of those barriers, that could bring real long-term advantages to economies on both sides of the Atlantic. But of course, you're right. At these summits, people always do tend to over-egg things. I suspect we're going to see a bit of that later on when it comes to the tax agreement that you just alluded to. There's still a lot of work to be done there. I was just speaking to some of the charities campaigning on tax transparency, and they admit they don't quite know how these talks are going to come out. And it's unusual at a G8 summit where everything's usually pretty well pre-cooked that we don't quite know how it's going to end up.
Overnight, we saw the OECD talking about automated information sharing to a much greater extent than we've seen before. What else might they be looking at?
Well, probably the most contentious issue on the agenda this morning when they get onto tax is this idea of who owns companies. Who's the ultimate owner of a company? This is part of a big international crackdown on tax evasion, which, of course, is illegal. The UK government announced over the weekend that it would be setting up a register of what they call beneficial ownership, who's the ultimate beneficiary of company ownership. But this is going to be held privately initially. That means the information will be handed over to the tax authorities but won't be made available to public scrutiny. Now, a lot of the charities here are saying, well, it's all very well and a step in the right direction if you create these registers in all the main economic centres of the world. But actually, people should have the right to inspect these registers. And there's a lot of resistance from that around the table, from countries I guess you might expect to be a bit worried about it, for example, like Russia, but also Canada, which has issues around tax confidentiality, and Germany, which has problems with its federal structure of government. So there are all sorts of problems which have to be overcome. And I think that question about whether you actually make more public who owns companies is going to be the real sticking point this morning.
George Parker, political editor of the Financial Times, thank you very much indeed for joining us from the Media Centre at the G8 Summit.
Michelle is due to arrive at around 10:30. She's going to the visitor centre first. She's getting the audio visual of Glendalough. She's been taken on a guided tour by George McLafferty to the Deerstone, up into the graveyard, around the round tower at the cathedral, back down to the visitor centre, into the car, and going for a private viewing to the lake with her family only, and her own photographer seemingly are the only ones that's going to be allowed with her visit to the lake.
That's Fianna Fáil councillor and owner of the Glendalough Hotel, Patrick Casey. He says Michelle Obama's visit is a huge honour for the area.
Hopefully we'll have good weather, number one, because Glendalough looks its best in good weather. You have the whole Christianity, the monastic site of Glendalough, but the backdrop to that is the severe beauty that Glendalough brings. And we all know when you go for a walk in Glendalough, your mind goes into a different place. And hopefully she'll get that calming effect that Glendalough brings to people.
This is the Deer Stone. It's also known as the Wishing Well.
64-year-old John Holden has lived in Glendalough all his life. He says there's a myth attached to the Deer Stone that Michelle Obama will visit today.
Way back, there was a child and there wasn't enough milk for the baby, and a deer came down. It was in St. Kevin's time and put milk into the stone here, and as a result the father of the child was able to feed the child. Now in relation to later times and years, we call it the wishing well. You would sit up there and then put your five fingers into the holes that are on the rock, and then put your hand into the bullon, as we call that, which is the Irish word for basin, and you get a wish.
Local Fine Gael TD Andrew Doyle says the First Lady's visit will give a boost to tourism in the area.
We have tours here daily by the droves of people, tourists from America and other places, but certainly there's no doubt that this visit, if there's television cameras, it'll be beamed coast to coast across the USA. So I think that will definitely, you know, put us on the map and make us a visiting place for tourists from America.
Visitors to Glendalough say they're sure Michelle Obama will be impressed by both the scenery and the history of the monastic site.
I think she'll think it's just very peaceful and beautiful. Hopefully the weather's very nice on the upper lake where we are at the moment. But the views around all the lakes are gorgeous here. And even if she walks up towards the waterfalls, I think she'll just find it very tranquil and very, very different to what she's used to.
We're in the Garden County of Ireland. I think the rain is due, and it could be due when she arrives, but I think regardless of the weather, it's breathtaking.
Locals and business owners in the area say they're excited about the visit.
I'm Pauline Fahey, the manager of the Brocka Resource Centre here in Lara, Glendalough. Locally, people in the community are very honoured to have Michelle Obama visit Glendalough, not only as the President's wife, but also as a woman, a great woman in her own right. So we're delighted to have her and her two children come to visit our community in Glendalough.
I'm Caroline Carney. I own the ice cream unit in Glendalough. Very excited. We're all very excited here. Myself and my friend are going to be here. We'll be looking out for our fashion, see what she's going to be wearing. And I believe the two girls are coming with her. So I'd be delighted if maybe they'd look over, maybe come and buy a cone.
My name is Michael Quinn. I live in Glendalough and I run a stall selling jewellery, souvenirs, gifts. I'd love to meet her, yeah, and I would love to give her a little gift. I have a little golf marcus for Obama himself. He plays golf, and if the lady wants to pick a jumper or pick something, it'll be more than a pleasure to give her a gift.
I'm sure that the local ladies, including the local men as well, will be peeping over the bridge and trying to get by security men to try and get a glimpse of this model, I suppose, coming from America. I'd be honoured to meet her. And please God, I will meet her, given that I'm just a stone's throw from where she will be. You know, it's great that she come to Glendalough. That's special, I think, you know. And for me, anyway, it's special. Being a native and being born in the area here, it is a special occasion, and I'd be delighted to shake her hand. I really would.
64-year-old John Holden there. He has lived all his life in Glendalough, finishing Aisling Kenny's report.
Now, we had Sam Maguire on the programme yesterday for the GAA football qualifiers draw, and Sam Maguire joins us again today from a long way away. Although I should explain, this is not the original All-Ireland trophy, but a replica which has been in Donegal hands for obvious reasons since last September. It's on a visit at the moment to Australia for a purpose which its minder, Kieran Kelly, chairman of the Donegal GAA Finance Committee, is about to explain to us. He's on the phone now from Melbourne. Kieran, good morning or good evening to you.
Good evening, Cal. How are you? I'm actually in Sydney, in downtown Sydney at the moment.
All right. What are you doing with Sam down under?
Suppose we've taken Sam Maguire on a tour that it has never been on before. We've taken Sam Maguire to promote Donegal GAA in Australia. It's the first time ever that Sam Maguire has taken a trip down under, and it's helping raise funds for a new training centre for Donegal GAA.
This is the one to be built in Convoy.
This is the one to be built in Convoy. It's a new purpose-built training centre of five training pitches. It's a new home for all Donegal teams, not alone our senior All-Ireland winners, but for all teams in all age groups.
Now, what kind of reaction have you got since you arrived on Sunday?
absolutely phenomenal. I have seen people from all over Ireland. I've seen jerseys from from every corner of Ireland. The GAA is absolutely huge in Australia, and the Sam Maguire really has taken those people to the different venues that we've been in, and the GAA brings everybody together, no matter where it is in the world.
And I gather some people from Kerry who know a bit about the Sam Maguire have also been present.
We've been asked by two famous Kerry men if they could gatecrash our parties, and we actually allowed them to tag Kennelly, who played with the Sydney Swans and also with Kerry, and Tommy Walsh. Both have attended a function that we held on Sunday night, which was a huge success. And the guys were very, very happy to see Sam in Australia.
All right, Kieran, we're running out of time, but how long will Sam be in Australia, and where can people find out about where it's going to be next?
Sam Maguire is heading for Melbourne tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. The Donegal Association in Melbourne have a number of events planned for us. And if somebody can, you know, I have my details on Twitter and on Facebook. And if anybody wants to contact us to have the Sam Maguire at their venue, we'd be more than happy to do that.
All right. And by the way, how much do you hope to raise? How much would you like to raise?
I would like to raise a lot more than I've already raised, Cal, but we're hoping to raise in the region of 30,000 to 40,000 Australian dollars while we're here.
All right, well, the best of luck with it, and we'll get the links from you now and we'll pass them on. But Kieran, thank you very much for talking to us. Kieran Kelly, Chairman of the Donegal GAA Finance Committee, coming up to 9 o'clock.
It's looking like we'll get some proper summer weather today, but over the past 5 years, we've had a collection of odd and unpleasant seasons. They've had something similar across the water, so this morning the British Met Office is hosting a special meeting of academics and meteorologists. Doug Parker is Professor of Meteorology at the University of Leeds. He'll be there, and he's been telling me about the gathering.
I think everybody, the scientists and the general public, are aware that we've had a run of rather unusual seasons in the past few years. And I think the public are aware of that, and it's you know, scientifically demonstrable. These are quite significant events. So the real question that we wanted to ask is how can we understand whether these are to do with climate change or whether these are simply a reflection of the natural variability in the system and just that we've had a run of kind of bad luck in terms of the events that we've been having.
And what's your own view at the moment?
Well, my view is that that we need more evidence, really, particularly in terms of the physical processes which are controlling our climate. So I think when people ask, you know, about each season, then they're given sort of simple answers. So they, you know, maybe told that the change in the weather is to do with the change in the jet stream or something like that. But actually then, if you've got an inquiring mind, you'd say, well, why has the jet stream changed? And that's a much more complicated question. So recently, there have been some evidence, for instance, that the declining sea ice in the Arctic, which has been quite a significant global climate effect in the past few years, may have changed the behaviour of the jet stream and of our weather systems. So there's some open questions, really, and I think the point of our meeting is to come together and refine those questions and figure out what we have to do to kind of come up with definitive answers.
How unusual has the weather been over the past 3 or 4 years?
Well, I think if you take any of the events that we've encountered, so if you take one of the, say the cold spring that we've just had in March,
mm-hmm.
We have had events like that in the past, and people with long memories will remember those events. So 1962 is a significant one where it was very cold. It was a cold winter and it was a very cold spring. So 62 is in fact colder than the one we just had. So the event we've had is not outside the natural realms of our climate system. So what's been unusual is really the fact that we've had a sequence of seasons with rather extreme conditions. Not you know, absolutely extreme conditions, but you know, we've had some floods, we've had some droughts, we've had cold winters, we've had cold springs. So it's really the fact that they've happened together that is making us ask these questions.
What do you hope, then, that today's gathering will achieve?
Well, I think one of the good things about today's grouping is that it's bringing together researchers from the universities and the Met Office And I think I'm hoping that we will come up with some definitive plans, really, or strategy for answering some of the main questions. I think it's also a good opportunity for us. I mean, we're all coming to this with open minds to share some of the new ideas that have been published recently, or ideas which are not quite published. So I'm hoping to learn something personally, but also I'm hoping that we'll have a pathway forward to do the research which will help us answer these questions.
And that was Doug Parker, Professor of Meteorology at the University of Leeds.